G'day, I'm Mark Pesce, and welcome to the final episode of This Week in Startups Australia. Jason Calacanis reached out and said, Mark, let's do a version of This Week in Startups for Australia. And over that decade, I have talked to so many startups and investors and news and stories. All of it has been amazing. And it's time to draw time. So this is the final episode of This Week in Startups Australia, but it's going to be a good one. We have the guardian angel of this podcast, Murray Herps from UTS Startups, going through the Startup Muster Report. What does it tell us about the state of affairs in Australia's startup ecosystem? That's on this final episode of This Week in Startups Australia. We're going to dive right into the state of play of Australia's startup ecosystem in 2025. We've got the Startup Muster data, and best of all, we've got the driving force behind Startup Muster on Twista. Murray Herps isn't just the guardian angel of this podcast. He also heads up UTS Startups and leads Startup Muster. I don't know where Murray gets time for all of this, but we are glad to have him. Murray, welcome back to This Week in Startups Australia. You're tip and tailing this series. You were on the first episode and you're on the last.
I'm so happy. This is Merry Christmas, everyone. And as you can see, we've got the Ouija board ready to predict the future. And I'm so happy to be here. This is my happy place. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. All right. Let's start with the big takeaways from this year's Startup Muster. What do you want us to know and remember?
Well, unsurprisingly, it is AI. And we'll get into kind of detail on this, but I was expecting AI. So this is basically a survey of startups, and the startups that we reach in Australia are the ones connected to incubators, accelerators, investors, educators. So it is a snapshot of the startup ecosystem to the extent we have one. So that ecosystem is who is answering this, and we are seeing an amazing progression in terms of the speed of adoption of AI and the impact that is happening on staff profiles and a lot of other aspects of them. Are you ready for some numbers?
Sure.
Okay. 51% of startups said they were building an AI product or service.
Okay.
So that's the first time we've asked that question, but it was amazing as an immediate kind of effect, I think. The average number of full-time employees basically dropped in half over a one-year period. So this is the same age of companies, same funding profile, a lot of other demographic similarities, and just everything else is the same. They're just employing fewer people, and they're saying we will hire fewer people as well. So that went from 5 planned hires last year to 3.5 this year. 62% said they're using AI for key job functions. And particularly in software and content creation and marketing, which you would expect. Anthropic and Google rising significantly in terms of utilization of their model. They were virtually nowhere to be seen last year in what people were using, and now they're quite dominant against OpenAI. 25% of startups said they were hosting AI in Australia, which I question. That sounds surprisingly high. Maybe that's a little bit of local LLMs or a little bit of optimistic thinking about where this stuff is actually hosted. The startups that have successfully raised funding said they had spoken to 150 investors to achieve that this year versus 100 last year and 72 the year prior. But they all say they spent the same amount of time doing it. It was an average of 450 hours to achieve the funding that they secured. So I think AI is having an impact there in terms of outreach to lots of people. Similarly, the use of external consultants for grant applications going down consistently each year. So 20% 2 years ago, 17%, and then 12% this year. I think that's AI as well. So I'm interested to see the AI slop that is going into all those grant applications, God help them. And in terms of like online learning, for example, ChatGPT has been like exploding in the time it's been available. It's now the number one choice. 70% of people using that as their primary source of learning in startups. Now look at all of those. I'm curious what you think.
So, top line, Claude Code, which came out basically this year as the Anthropic tool, changed everything in terms of software, right? And I know from both my own experience and from the people that I'm talking to that although it wasn't that great when it came out, it's now very good. And so I think what we're seeing around the smaller team sizes is a reflection of the fact that a single engineer is now capable of 2x throughput, maybe more. But we're also seeing, and this is being reflected, I think, broadly in the industry, because Latent Space has been talking about this, the emergence of what they call the tiny team, where everyone on the team is working really closely and is really augmented with AI tools. And so there's a multiplier effect, not just on the individual, but in the team.
Definitely.
Right. And so that's possibly why we're seeing that. The question then is, are we going to see more startups taking off because there's less people being sucked up into the ecosystem? Does that mean there's going to we're seeing, or is it simply going to be more founders doing more with less? Well, the same number of founders doing more with less.
I think we have to see more. I think the only answer is yes, we need more because people will need to be doing things. It's interesting the tool choices that people said they were using. Like they would name the mainstream kind of tools that you would expect, but a very small proportion were using things like Replit or Windsurf or some of the tools that you might
Cursor.
expect. So that was surprising in terms of diffusion of new tools. So it's being adopted very quickly, but I think a lot of the more specialized things are not diffusing as quickly as you might expect. So there's opportunity there. You look at the education level, so that like we've got education creep across the world, but in this to see like the most common educational attainment that people have being master's degrees, and 31% of startup founders having master's, and then in third place was PhDs at 12%. So there's
Is that
extremely
okay? So
qualified
is that
people.
okay? And I don't want to jump ahead of the story, but it brings up: do we have a division around what we would think of as sort of the normal startup versus deep tech? Is that 12% sitting in deep tech, or are they sort of across the ecosystem?
There is a surprising amount of deep tech coming through. I think it was about 25% of those represent deep tech, so research, commercialization, or patentable, protectable things. I think 56% of people said their startup was related to the area of study. So there is a nice tie back. Like you could say, yes, we are extremely qualified, but we are actually using the qualifications in the companies we're starting. So hopefully those PhDs, et cetera, are resulting in more companies, even if it's not. And I think this is something people often overlook. They talk about research, commercialization, and collaboration. And there's surprising amounts of that in the data we have that never count researcher translation of all these people that leave academia and do wonderful things, which is, I think, strongly represented here.
Do we have any sense of what the spread is in terms of degrees, both in the master's and the PhDs?
We are at 31% masters and 12% PhDs.
So, but
So,
where are they? What disciplines, I guess, is what I'm
oh, I'm sorry.
asking.
No,
Okay.
unfortunately.
Wait, so.
But this is the wonderful thing about running a survey, is it's the best possible way of coming up with questions for a survey, because you immediately figure out, oh, we should have asked that. Which is, again, a benefit of having Startup Muster since 2013. We have had a lot of opportunities to figure out things we've missed, and hence why it's so long. There's about 300 questions in a divergent survey that address a lot of things from a lot of different parts of government and startup supporters that need to understand little bits of information that you can't get any other way.
Okay, so is it getting easier or harder to launch a startup in 2025? I mean, yeah, you can do it smaller. Does that mean it's, it sounds like there's the people are still able to reach capital, but they have to go to more places. So let's talk about that. Is there more friction in the system or less, or is it the same?
I don't want to give a cop-out answer of it depends what a startup is, but that's the answer, because I think it's never been easier to launch a tech-enabled company that can make lots of money very fast. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, you'll remember SEO people, if they were very good, they never worked for someone else because they figured out they can make more money by themselves and they become self-employed. Good AI people are now the same. They are all self-selecting into self-employment and starting these companies instead. But if you can get to customers, build something that has really interesting per capita revenue, right, it's hard. Like, A, I think they're not looking for funding in the same way that they used to. And B, I think that puts them on a different trajectory of they will be very happy as founders. But what is the inflection point that makes them go, yes, I want a hyper growth, high risk, high reward company? That lack of early VC, I think, will result in less of those kind of companies.
So this is... I mean, it feeds in. So the episode before this, we just talked to Cheryl Mack and Andrea Gardner. And of course, they represent, you know, what we would think of as very early stage investing, right? Angel investing and then seed stage investing, you know, sort of before you bring the big guys in. And we were talking about the lay of the land here, which had altered because, again, it got very hard to raise capital during the period of inflation. That seems to have moderated. The world's come back into balance. But now... are we seeing an era? Because again, if you're a sole founder-ish AI, you're using the tools and you're on the tools and you have a pipeline into clients, that's, you know, I mean, I think the term of art right now is the ramen startup. Like, you can completely self-fund off the bowl of ramen that you can afford from doing that. Is that what we're starting to see? Is there any of that being reflected in the data?
This is the annoying thing. Not as much. It's reflected in the employment data and some of the side effects of what people say they're using. But not as much in the impediments to start or the challenges that people face. I think there's a interesting kind of, what's the right word? There's an interesting absorption of capability that people do. Like, I won't sit here and acknowledge that my laptop is an amazing thing and allows me to do all the things that I do. I will just use it and it becomes what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I think the same happens in AI. It's not reflected in, we ask people about what are the critical enablers that they had or like the things that were like required to do the things that they're doing at the moment. And as open text fields, they never name these kind of things. But if you then ask, are you using these things? What are you using them for? They say yes. So I think it's reflected there. And I think it's also reflected in people are figuring out that people like dealing with humans. Mm. And if you present yourself specifically as an AI solution that devalues what you're doing, if I can have a choice between an AI Mark Pesce or a real Mark Pesce, I will pay more for the real Mark Pesce. And you as a company will not ever acknowledge that you're not real. So I fear the AI change will be somewhat hidden in what people acknowledge.
That's a really interesting point, because it's not so much that we're seeing creep here, but that the tools themselves are creating a kind of distance around that. That's, I guess we're going to have to see how that evolves for the next couple of years. Let's pop up a level. Let's talk about the differences between the states. What have we learned about where things are taking off and where things are slowing down?
So we asked people, this might have been a bad idea, but we asked people, how do you rate your state government in terms of their support for startups? And congratulations, South Australia, because they came through extremely strong. Okay. We had South Australia number one at 45%, saying they were above average. Queensland at 39%, ACT at 39%, Victoria at 28%, Western Australia at 20%, New South Wales then at 18%, Tasmania at 13%. There's some angry people down in Tasmania for some reason. But it was also interesting, though, because we asked people, what do you want from government? And for the first time in the entire Startup Muster history, there were fewer people saying, I want funding from government. So this is maybe one of those signals towards a lower startup cost. But it was about 50% on average if you thematically cluster people's text responses. And now it was 40%, which is, I think, a significant year-on-year change. I'm curious to see what happens in future. It's definitely not more funding being available, because we then ask, which grants have you used? Which did you apply for? Which are you planning? And those numbers are amazingly consistent year-on-year.
But I mean, again, to go back to your original point, if the team is smaller, if the team is 3 to 4 people rather than 8 to 9 people, and in an early stage startup, salaries are the biggest expense you're going to have, right? There's no question. So if you really cut under that, then it does become that much more viable. That's also really interesting. That's going to have a whole set of implications that we're probably not even quite clear on yet.
Yeah. For example, like we asked people, what did you find difficult in dealing with these government programs? And normally the complexity came across as a strong theme. This year, it was like significantly declined from last year. So, is the intelligibility of this complex kind of set of documentation suddenly a lot easier if it can say, hey, ChatGPT, am I eligible for this or not? But I just imagine the world we're in a year from now where every company that can fund these programs is able to.
Because of
And
Apollo 1 and other tools, right?
absolutely. It's the data is there, the assistance is there. And I think the problem will be on the government side of how to deal with this.
Okay. So we know that people are fleeing New Zealand in droves right now, right? There's a bit of a thing going on. Poor New Zealand. I feel very bad for them. Are people fleeing Australia to go to other zones for opportunities now, or are we seeing people come this way?
That's a good question. The proportion of people that are planning to leave hasn't really changed. But for the first time, we did ask, why do you stay in Australia? For the ones that are operating here, what keeps you here? And then for the ones that are leaving, what made you want to leave? And I'm not surprised by this, but also slightly sad that, like, far and away, the most convincing reasons people express for why they stay here is the quality of life, 23%, family ties, another 15%, and then other kind of life-related things. So Australia is a wonderful place to live, but they're not naming capital availability or talent or other things in particular. And when they leave, or occasionally they might have an Australia-focused product if you're in fintech or something else that can make sense as well. And when they leave, it's for market opportunities, 51%. And occasionally the next one was access to capital at 12%. So people often would expect it to be capital or customers, but it's really this better markets to operate in that people are chasing. Again, not surprising, but it's nice to see it in a chart.
What about the division between cities and regions? It's been historically harder to do a startup regionally. Is that still the case?
So I think Australia has the world's most geographically dispersed startup ecosystem. Like the average distance between people is crazy. We have these small pockets that are basically different countries in terms of how far there is between them. And I think massively underrated is the opportunity that presents to go slightly outside of that. We still have really strong clustering that I think is slightly unproductive at times. You look at how people are choosing to work from an office. There's now a high of 72% of startups that have no requirement for their employees to work in the office. But 28% of founders are working entirely from home. So compare those two. The founders like being in an office, but teams are not. So regional starts to make more sense. We compared regional experiences to metropolitan. 72% said their costs were significantly lower than they would be in a capital city. So their perception of it is quite good. And they rated their quality of life higher as well. And it was interesting in terms of they had slightly lower funding ambitions. So they were trying to raise smaller amounts, maybe reflecting a lower cost of living and lower, smaller team sizes, maybe. But if you want a better quality of life and lower costs, do a regional startup.
Excellent. All right. So let's talk about the future that's made in Australia. All right. As someone who ran a manufacturing startup and had to do all of my manufacturing in China because there was no other way to do it, is that starting to change?
This was probably my biggest surprise out of this. So for years, I've wanted to add more into the survey around manufacturing, and this year we actually got around to it. And we asked, are people planning to manufacture, and what kind of keeps them from doing so, blah, blah, blah. And amazingly, 37% of these startups said they currently or plan to manufacture their products. So manufacture or assemble. And 33% of all of the startups said they plan to do some or all of that in Australia. And only 5% saying they plan to do all their manufacturing outside Australia.
Okay.
So
That's
that was.
really good, but that means that there's more infrastructure around than there was 12 years ago when I was doing Moore's Cloud, right? I mean that's literally the sign of that because there was you could do one-off contract manufacturing, but you could not do any sort of production runs. There simply was no infrastructure for it in the country at that point. Yeah.
Again, this is one of those things that make you think, okay, we need to add more questions for next year because the detail on this is fascinating. Like, what are they actually manufacturing? What do they need, et cetera? It is, I think, as we go into this kind of AI-enabled world, the enabling privileges of companies become more and more important. And manufacturing, the manufacturing part of this makes me very clear that we need to understand this a lot better. There is a hidden kind of industry of manufacturing startups in Australia that is not well understood. And I think we need to, especially with it being a national priority and so much interest.
And with it being, I'll speak to my own personal experience, manufacturing is the hardest thing you get to do. All right, it just is. And it sounds very flippant to say it. I advise anyone to go and try it and let me know how it went. All right, it's very hard because it's all moving pieces and they all break. And you don't know this until you try to make it and then everything breaks. And this is one reason why there are manufacturing hubs like Shenzhen that make things because they're really good at helping you do stuff that will break while you're making it and recovering from that. Manufacturing takes time and energy and memory. And if Australia is starting to build that memory, then in 5 years, in 10 years, it becomes something incredibly valuable because of the memory that's been built up around how to manufacture. So I agree with you. It feels like if we want a future made in Australia, the best way to do that is simply by making things. You don't need a plan, just start making things and just start keeping notes. But we'll see how that goes. All right. Are we getting a lot of international talent?
So I think Australia holds up a sign that says, beware the leopard, and please go away. There's an obvious desire to come to Australia that we don't tend to make very easy. I'd say in terms of startups using employees on visas, it was about the same. Graduate working visas and student visas were the most represented. So this is something important in terms of how people look at universities and international students. I think it is not recognized the proportion of, if you look at the combination of the two, it was, I think, about 10%-ish of startups that were using international students of some kind. And then about 9% of people that had arrived in Australia as adults and attended an educational organization that provides international education and then become startup founders. So, like, really significant numbers of people that come in through these channels and then either work for or start these companies. I think this is always the challenge. If I was prime minister for a day, I would be sacked the next day. And as I've said before, it would be because I would let more people in, which has terrible effects, but has great effects on our economy.
I mean, and that's the Australian dilemma, right? We don't have enough houses, but we do want more people, right? It's
Yes.
the great dilemma of Australia. All right. Now, you say startups aren't wanting things from government, but at the same time, it seems like there's a really low percentage of startups that are going for the R&D tax incentive, which I think is hilarious because, when we did Moore's Cloud, we spent a lot of money on research and development, and that was a very, very nice big tax rebate. Is there a disconnect here? Are people simply are founders simply unaware of this, or is it in a too hard basket for them?
So I won't comment directly on that because I'm chair of the R&D Incentives Committee, and I'll defer to government for their opinion on that program.
Fair enough.
I think everyone would agree it's an incredible program, and I would say personally, I think it is massively underutilized as a thing. And as are all the other things that are named in that list, IGP, for example, or the EMDG Export Market Development Grant.
Yeah.
These are not like being used or planned to be used by people in anywhere near the proportions that you would expect. So there's a, I think, awareness gap. But it that also doesn't explain it enough in terms of you have, this is an ecosystem of startups. All these people heard about Startup Muster from someone else that is supporting them. Why is that person not saying, hey, by the way, you should go and look at this because you're developing a microfluidic cell separator thing and you can probably get some support for that. I think people find out too late.
All right. It's interesting because we're now starting to see some areas where targeted campaigns could yield enormous effects, such as helping people to understand and even work their way through the R&D tax credit, helping them with the export development grant. Because, again, Austrade wants people to take their money and go do things with it and build export markets. That's kind of why they exist. All right. Let's sort of move towards some of the bigger conclusions. First off, and I haven't asked you this, and I should have asked you at the front, how many respondents are we talking about here?
We ended up at annoyingly 699 after validation, which I wish I could have added or removed one. But that was out of a initial pool of 1,192, and then we go through a lot of validation and check, are they actually scalable? Are they repeats from the same organization, et cetera? It was 163,000 questions answered. So you'll notice we take a strange approach to this because there's not unlimited startup founders we can survey. There's a small audience of busy, valuable people. Yep. So you make a very engaging survey that provides feedback and gives them reasons to actually take part. And you then make sure, absolutely sure, their data is used by a lot of people. This report normally will get about 30,000 downloads. Yep. There'll be like 40 different parts of government that use this. And so your data is actually worthwhile.
And where can people download the report?
Startupmuster.com. For any American listeners, it is Startupmuster, M-U-S-T-E-R. I'm sorry for my accent. It is not mustard. I figured out, like, year one, Muster is a difficult name. But Startupmuster.com, and it's free.
Excellent. All right. What are your final thoughts? Sum up 2025 for us and maybe get that Ouija board out and give us a look into 2026. What do you reckon?
So we're recording this on Wednesday. Report goes out on Friday. And I'm really curious to see how the public reacts to this. I think there's a proportion of people that will see it and go, oh no, AI is taking a lot of jobs and this is terrible and we need to regulate and rethink and blah, blah, blah. And there'll be a proportion of people that see, no, these people are using AI and are creating jobs and opportunities in different ways in terms of exports and other things that companies create. The largest economic impact of startups is not the direct employment from them. It never has been. It is learning spillovers when you go and work for CBA down the track, or competitive pressure or provision of new services to companies. So that productivity uplift happens everywhere if these companies do what they're trying to do. I think long-term, I've got a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, amazing. And I think every day about like, what are they going to be doing in 10, 15 years? And I think we have to design for a world where your laptop can do almost anything a normal undergrad can do. That's maybe a big call, but I think if you imagine that world and then think, okay, what am I doing in that world? You make really, really different choices. You think, okay, what kind of special things do I actually have? What markets do I understand? What network do I have? What access to things do I have? What industry knowledge do I have? Whatever else. And then how can I use that with this wonderful infinite laptop to do something that helps to solve a meaningful problem? I
And
think it changes how you look at what you actually do, and I think everyone is going to start to have to think about that.
I and my experience now with the coding tools is exactly this, that they've taken a quantum leap just in the past month, particularly Google Anti-Gravity, which is phenomenal. And all of a sudden, I don't code things because I simply don't have the time to code all the things that I want to code. It's not that I don't code at all anymore. I like to, but it takes time away from the other things I need to do. And all of a sudden, I got a tool that can take most of that work out of my hands. All I have to do is direct it well. It turns out that's the hard bit, though, because I've been programming for nearly 50 years. I can direct the tool really well.
How do you do that in your age? Working on double speed.
No. It's because I first had my first encounter with a computer in February 1976, which I'll be writing about for the Register next year, and it nothing was the same after that first encounter. And I think you've hit it on the head. It's about what is worth doing. If we've got this wide open now, what's worth doing? And that's a very different question, and it's a question people haven't often been confronted with.
Especially in Australia. And we have like looming massive problems in terms of our exports and strengths, traditional strengths. The education system needs to respond. Universities need to respond. Government needs to respond. And I hope on Friday when they start reading this, it is a contributor to that response and not a distraction from it.
And let that be your Christmas present, Murray. Thank you so much for joining us on the final episode of series of This Week in Startups Australia.
Thank you, Mark.
When this show first went to air, Australia's startup community was still almost really just in an infant state. We didn't really have well-developed capital. We had some capital availability, but we didn't have a lot of the ecosystem components that we have today. What I've been able to see over the last decade plus is that we actually have a fully mature ecosystem. Now, sure, there are ways it can always be better. There are things that can always be done differently. There are different kinds of support, different kinds of networks that will always need to be built. But the fact is, we're aware of that, and we have the resources to be able to focus on those problems and solve them. That's what's different than 10 years ago. So I have no doubt, particularly on the back of this latest Startup Muster report, that startups are going from strength to strength in Australia, that they will be a permanent fixture of how we think about economic growth in this country and what we think of when we think about the future for our work, for our careers, for our industries, and for our nation. You can't really ask for more than that. Big thanks to Murray Herbst for coming on to the show today and for being the guardian angel who has seen us through this last decade plus brilliantly. Thank you, Murray. Now, we have a website, twistartupsaus.com. It's not going anywhere, and it has all of the shows, all of the guests, all of the stories. It's all there at twistartupsaus.com. Now, if you like this show and if you want to share it with a friend, please do or subscribe. Now, there won't be any more episodes from here, but you'll get the entire back catalog to be able to listen to. And for the final time, this is Mark Pesce on This Week in Startups Australia, thanking you so much for listening. Thank you.